228. I hope people forgive me the discovery that all moral philosophy so far has been boring and has belonged among things which send us to sleep, and that, in my eyes, virtue has been impaired by nothing so much as by the tediousness of its advocates. In saying this, I still don't wish to deny their general utility. A great deal rests on the fact that as few people as possible think about morality, and so it's very important that morality does not one day become something interesting. But that's not something people should worry about. These days things still stand the way they always have. I don't see anyone in Europe who could have or could provide some idea about how reflecting on morality could be conducted dangerously, awkwardly, or seductively, that there could be some disaster in the process. People should consider, for example, the tireless, unavoidable English utilitarians, how they wander around crudely and honourably in Bentham's footsteps, moving this way and that. A Homeric metaphor says it more clearly, just as Bentham himself had already wandered in the footsteps of the Honourable Helvetius. This Helvetius, no, he was no dangerous man. No new idea, nothing of a more refined expression and bending of an old idea, not even a real history of an earlier idea. An impossible literature in its totality, unless we understand how to spice it up with some malice. For, in fact, even with these moralists, whom we really have to read with ulterior motives, if we have to read them, that old English vice called cant, which is moral tartuffery, hypocrisy, has inserted itself, this time hidden under a new form of scientific thinking. Nor is there any lack of a secret resistance against the pangs of a guilty conscience, something a race of former Puritans justifiably suffers in all its scientific preoccupations with morality. Isn't a moralist the opposite of a Puritan, namely, a thinker who takes morality as something questionable, worth raising questions about, in short, as a problem? Shouldn't moralizing be immoral? In the end, they all want English morality to be considered right, so that then mankind or general needs or the happiness of the greatest number, no, England's good fortune, will be best served. They want to prove with all their might that striving for English happiness, I mean for comfort and fashion, and as the highest priority a seat in Parliament, is at the same time also the right path to virtue. In fact, that all virtue which has existed in the world so far has consisted of just such striving. Not one of all these ponderous herd animals with uneasy consciences, who commit themselves to promoting egoism as an issue of general welfare, wants to know or catch a whiff of the fact that the general welfare is no ideal, no goal, not even a concept one can somehow grasp, but is only an emetic, that what is right for one man cannot in any way also be right for another man, that the demand of a single morality for everyone is a direct restriction on the higher men, in short, that there is a rank ordering between man and man, and thus, as a result, also between morality and morality. These utilitarian Englishmen are a modest and thoroughly mediocre kind of man, and, as mentioned, in so far as they are boring, we cannot think highly enough of their utility. We should even encourage them, just as, to some extent, someone has tried to do in the following rhyme. Hail to you, brave working lout! It's always better when drawn out. Always stiff in head and knee, never funny, never keen, always sticking to the mean, sans génie et sans esprit, without genius and without intelligence. 229. In those recent ages which may be proud of their humanity, there remains so much residual fear, so much superstitious fear of the wild, cruel beasts, animals which these more humane ages are particularly proud of having overcome, that even palpable truths stay unspoken for hundreds of years, as if by some agreement, because they look as if they might help these wild beasts, which have been finally slaughtered, come back to life again. Perhaps I am daring something if I allow one such truth to escape me. Let others catch it again and give it so much milk of the devout ways of thinking to drink until it lies still and forgotten in its old corner. People should learn to think differently about cruelty and open their eyes. They should finally learn to get impatient, so that such presumptuous fat errors no longer brazenly wander around as virtues, the way they've been fed to us, for example, by old and new philosophers in connection with tragedy. Almost everything which we call higher culture rests on the spiritualization and intensification of cruelty. That's my claim. That wild beast hasn't been killed at all. It's alive, it's flourishing. Only it has turned itself into a god. What constitutes the painful delight in tragedy is cruelty. What has a pleasing effect in so-called tragic pity, and basically even in everything awe-inspiring right up to the highest and most delicate trembling of metaphysics, gets its sweetness only from the addition of cruelty to the mixture. What the Roman in the arena, Christ in the raptures of the cross, the Spaniard at the sight of a burning at the stake or a bullfight, the Japanese today who crowds into tragedies, the Parisian suburban worker who feels nostalgic for a bloody revolution, the female fan of Wagner who, with her will unhinged, lets herself submit to Tristan and Isolde. What all these people enjoy and try to drink down with mysterious enthusiasm is the spicy liquor of the great Circe. Cruelty. In saying this, we must, of course, chase off the foolish psychology of former times, which, so far as cruelty is concerned, knew only how to teach us that it arose at the sight of someone else's suffering. There is a substantial overabundant enjoyment also with one's own suffering, with making oneself suffer. And wherever people let themselves be convinced about self-denial in a religious sense or about self-mutilation, as with the Phoenicians and ascetics, or in general about depriving themselves of sensual experience and the flesh, about remorse, Puritan pangs of repentance, a vivisection of the conscience, and Pascal's sacrificio dell'intelletto, sacrifice of the intellect, they are secretly seduced and pushed on by cruelty, by that dangerous thrill of cruelty turned against themselves. Finally, people should consider that even the knowledgeable man, when he compels his spirit to acknowledge things against his spirit's inclinations, and often enough also against his heart's desires, that is to say, no, where he'd like to affirm something, to love and worship, rules as an artist and a transformer of cruelty. In fact, every attempt to be profound and thorough is a forceful violation, a willingness to do harm to the basic will of the spirit, which always wants what's apparent and superficial. Even in that desire to know, there is a drop of cruelty.